Now, I want to go today into the subject of the male-female symbolism in tantric yoga. You will find that in the tantric art forms, that every Buddha or aspect of the Buddha has a feminine counterpart. And that not only do they have feminine counterparts, but they also have various levels on which they're represented. In other words, we started out, you remember, I described in the last seminar, there were the idea of five so-called Jnani Buddhas. And these five, who represent, as it were, the center of a rose, one's in the middle and four surround. Then each one has a corresponding bodhisattva form. And then each bodhisattva has in turn a corresponding heruka form, but they're all forms of the original five. Then whether they're in the form of a Jnani Buddha, or in the form of a bodhisattva, or in the form of a heruka, which is kind of wrathful and weird, far out to kind of a character often with bull's heads. This one here, which we can look at as a little statue that Kim has brought over. They're all reducible to the original group. And all have these female counterparts, and they are represented as in sexual intercourse, touching at all points, in a complete embrace. And the idea is that this embrace lasts forever and ever and ever and ever and never ends. Because this is a way of representing the nature of life. What is fundamentally involved in this system is self-knowledge. You see, if without resonance, nothing happens. If there are no echoes, you can't hear anything. Supposing we get a room in which we blanket all the walls and blanket the floor, soundproof it in every possible direction, you can hardly hear anyone talk because voice requires resonance. That's why people enjoy singing in the bathtub. They suddenly discover they've got a good voice, because suddenly the bath and the structure of the room, which is all non-soundproofed, resonates their voice. That's why you use a violin or a cello or a bass fiddle has a big wooden structure to make the sound resonant, to play back to itself. And that's why we are all so fascinated with recording things, taking photographs, writing them down, and above all, remembering. It's a form of resonance. Because you see, if you don't remember anything, you don't know you're there. A person who had total amnesia and lived in a split second only wouldn't know he was there. We could conceive, and perhaps there are some forms of life that don't know they're there. I don't know whether my particular cells constituting my body, I don't know whether they know they're there. Maybe they do. Maybe they have some wonderful system of resonance that I know nothing about, and they're all worried about what I'm going to do with them. And having conferences and meetings and policy decisions and so on and so forth, because this person in charge... You know, it might well be that when I die, or when we all die, all our cells suddenly say, God is dead. And they have their big theological controversy. And say, well, we just have to fend for ourselves from now on. And that's called corruption. When they all go off on their own. I don't know. It may be that we've got some kind of a system like that. But certainly, to know that you're there, you need an echo. So I invented this limerick. There was a young man who said, though, it seems that I know that I know. What I would like to see is the eye that knows me when I know that I know that I know. So this is the thing, you see. Not only do you remember what happened and say it made an impression on me, which means it made me remember, like your retina remembers whatever is seen, so that it sticks there a little. In other words, that's why you get the illusion of a circle of fire when you revolve a cigarette in the dark. It makes the impression of a circle because your retina remembers and holds, as it were, the impression of the flame. And so then, beyond that, we are absolutely fascinated with the whole principle of remembering. And so then, when there's some gathering of people, and we say, well, this is a great day, what a wonderful picnic or whatever it is we're having, it's a pity somebody didn't bring a camera. It should have been photographed. Now, do you see that in this whole thing, there is both a gain and a loss? One school of people are saying it should be photographed. The other school of people are saying, let go of it. When you go around, we had so much experience of this in Japan, because all our students brought cameras and were constantly photographing things. And I had a camera and I was constantly photographing things, but I felt that so long as I had a camera with me, I was somehow distracted from actuality. I had a little box with which I went around grabbing life. Of course, it's great to come back and look at it in the form of photographs, but there's something about the photograph that is inferior to the actual experience that you're photographing. But there is an immense fascination in photography, in painting, in reproducing. And reproducing, you see, is the same thing as sexuality. It is reproduction. Only in another way. Because it tells you you're there. You're alive. The thing bounces. It echoes. So the duplicity in all this is, you see, one school of religious people say, let it all go. Don't be attached. In other words, and they also say, live in the moment. Like Krishnamurti's doctrine of stop trying to remember everything. You may need a kind of factual memory for your name and address and telephone number and things like that. But don't linger over memories and treasure memories and say, well, I'm going to keep my girlfriend's lock of hair and I'll take it out every now and then and look at it and feel wonderful, you see. That's clinging to life, because that memory has got you hooked. It holds you to the past. And it holds you to death. But then there's the other school of thought, you see, quite opposite to this, which says, remember to remember, title of one of Henry Miller's books. Hold on to it all. Get involved. Keep your girlfriend's hair. Keep all the photographs. You know how in some houses the piano, everything is completely covered with photographs and reminiscences. I went to visit Gloria Swanson once. I've never seen such a house full of memories. Everything in all directions was Gloria Swanson. Photographed on this occasion, signed on that occasion, presentation this. I went to visit once too the wife of a former Archbishop of Canterbury. And the whole house was memorials. I mean, it was a complete clutter of tombstone furniture with little brass plates on it, presented on the occasion of this, that, and the other. Well, you say, look, that person isn't really living. And they're all in the past. But on the other hand, what is life, you see, except there is a memory, except there is an echo. So what I want to point out, you see, is the duplicity of all this. That you don't take, if you're a wise man, you don't take sides in this issue. You do both sides. And that is the meaning of the unity of samsara and nirvana. On the one hand, you let go of everything and you live in the eternal now, because that's all there is. See, memory is an illusion. It's all gone. So everything you know about that makes an impression on you is no longer there. That's the meaning of Maya. There is only the eternal now. There is only the present moment. There never will be anything else. Because even what you're remembering is happening in the present. The memory is in the eternal now, isn't it? See? So it's all really absolutely here. But on the other hand, what fun to drag it out and to make it echo and to get involved and to fall in love and to become attached. Once R.H. Blythe wrote and said to me, I may have told some of you this story before, he wrote me a letter and said, what are you doing these days? As for me, I am abandoning all kinds of satori and enlightenment, and I'm trying to become as deeply attached to as many people and as many things as possible. As these are the two sides, see? So, the thing is this. It's just like riding a bicycle. It's a balance trick. You suddenly find yourself falling over one way, well, you balance that, you turn into that direction, and you stay up. And so in the same way, when you find yourself becoming too attached to life, you correct that with the realization that there is nothing except the eternal now. Then when you feel that's all right now, you see, you're safe again, this is only the eternal now, once more you go and get attached. Or you get involved, you get concerned about some enterprise, social, political, amorous, familial, scholarly, artistic, whatever it is, you get involved. And the two always go together. So this is the meaning of this symbolism. Because the male only knows he's there if there's a female. It's the echo. And she only knows she's there if there's a male. Nobody ever came into existence without a couple of parents, see? And there's simply no other way into this universe. Now, this is simply, I'm using this simply not as the main point, but as a sort of illustration of the simultaneity of attachment, detachment, involution and evolution. Involution is how you get involved, evolution is how you get out. Well now, this tantric yoga represents all this in the most extraordinary symbolism, which is basically the human body. Again, it's not simply the sexual functioning of the human body, it's the whole nervous system. If you really dig into this, you will find that there is a psychic anatomy, and this psychic anatomy in yoga philosophy belongs to what I explained yesterday as the subtle body. You must not expect to find this in the physical organism, nor must you expect to find that there is, in addition to the physical organism, a sort of spook that goes round with us. The physical body is the body as examined by others. The subtle body is the way you feel yourself. Now, there is an anatomy of the subtle body, which consists of the process of involution and evolution. There is a spinal tree, and it's represented as having two paths down it. It is represented as a canal called the Sushumna. And then in this canal there are two routes. One is called the Ida and the other is called the Pingala. P-I-N-G-L-A and the I-D-A, Ida. And on one current, something is going down. And on the other, something is coming up. And you will recognize, I think, the familiar image of two serpents on a rod, the caduceus, carried by Mercury. And alchemically, you see, Mercury, the mirror substance, is the void, is the pure, clear light, the same thing as the Buddhist diamond. Now, down at the base of the spinal column, according to the chakra system, there is what's called the Kundalini, which is the serpent power. And the symbol of the serpent power is an inverted triangle with a phallus upright and erect and a sleeping serpent coiled all the way around the phallus. That is, in other words, involution, to be absolutely involved. And the sex symbol is used again because sex stands for, symbolically, complete involvement. Now, when you've got in, the trick is to get out. See? So then, the process of yoga is represented as waking up that sleeping serpent, who is under the sleep of Maya, who's captivated by illusion, and thinks that the world really exists. In other words, the female echo of himself, or the male echo of herself, has captivated you. Memory has caught you, and you think it's all really there, and you don't realize there's only the eternal now. And you need to know that in order not to get quite lost. Because if you go out to any one end of the spectrum, you forget you're there. That's sort of a non-existence. You can't really non-exist. You'll always come back eventually. But if you get one extreme too much, you don't know you're there. So then, the symbol is that you draw up the energy located in the Kundalini, which is the sex center, and you send it back up the spinal tree to the top again, from which it came. Now, this is the theory of sex yoga. The theory is that the male and the female partners, who, as I explained yesterday, are husband and wife, or some kind of spiritual marriage, what they do is this. The male sits in the normal meditation posture, and the female sits on top of him, wrapping her legs round his waist and her arms round his neck, and he holds her round the waist. And in this position, they arouse the sexual force. Now, the theory goes on to say this, that instead of dissipating this energy in the ordinary way, having aroused it, they send it up the spinal tree, back into the brain. Now, don't take this literally. This is a symbolism. It's just the same kind of superstition as thinking that heaven is somewhere up in the sky and that there really are streets of gold and angels wandering around in nighties with harps. All this is a way of talking about inner anatomy, psychic anatomy. The kingdom of heaven is within you. And when Jesus ascended into heaven, he went right into the middle of himself and disappeared. You know? And like the gates of heaven, they are pearls. People think the pearly gates are gates covered in pearls. There's nothing of the kind. The gates of heaven are pearls. Each one is one pearl. And you know, a pearl has a very thin hole through it for the thread to go in. And that's why a camel can't go through the eye of a needle. Because you have to become no one to get through that hole. That's why the idea of many incarnations is likened to beads strung together on a thread. And this thread is called the Sutra Atman, sutra is a thread. Atman, the self, the threading self that hangs all the beads together. But it's so thin, you see, that it's like nobody. The real you. You have to divest yourself of all hang-ups, you see, to discover the real you. Well, we're back again to the thing of pulling the snake up the tree, the serpent power up. You have to let go of the hang-ups and realize that there are no possessions, everything's falling away, all your memories are holding on to illusions. And then when you thoroughly understand that, you can go back in. So you've got a marvelous picture of the world as a sort of systole and diastole of attachment and detachment, attachment and detachment. And this takes us right back, you see, the bodhisattva who is liberated, who has let go and is no longer attached, given up memory, and this is the meaning of giving up woman, who is your resonator. Give that up, see, and you find you're free. There's only the eternal now. So the bodhisattva, instead of staying there, goes back in. And there are all sorts of funny symbolic stories about bodhisattvas appearing in the world as whores and all kinds, using every conceivable kind of device in order to liberate other beings. But this takes us completely back, you see, to the original Hindu image of the world as the pralaya and the manvantara. The manvantara is the period in which Brahma manifests himself as multiple beings for 4,320,000 years, and the pralaya is the period in which he withdraws and everything disappears. And then starts all over again, and this goes on forever and ever and ever, in not only our kind of time, but in many other kinds of time, and in all sorts of different kinds of spaces. But it's the same fundamental myth, recreated in another form. Now you may say this is pretty monotonous. And that is, you see, one of the basic feelings underlying Buddhism. Must we go round again? See? So, indeed, you see, you say, oh, enough of this. Let's go to sleep. Let's stop. Time must have a stop. And so you stop. Well, when you do that, you forget that it ever happened. You see? And this is a marvelous arrangement. Because then it can start all over again without your knowing that it happened before. So you're never bored. And this is a cure for being tired of it. Because if you didn't know, I mean, that's where the memory goes, you see. And so when you come back, there's no problem. At least no problem of boredom, of remembering the past. There's going to be all sorts of new problems. But you won't know you've had any problems before. So that won't worry you. Until you begin to accumulate memories again, and you've had these problems, and it's becoming a bore dealing with problems, and then you get rid of yourself. It's called death. It's a beautiful arrangement for keeping everything young and new. And for keeping the universe running without getting tired of itself. And that's the definition of keeping on. So you see, these are the two motions. They're fundamentally then represented by the male and the female, the in and the out, the now moment, and the memory. See, memory, remember, creates the future as well as the past. You wouldn't know you were going to have anything happen tomorrow unless something had happened yesterday. You figure because the sun rose yesterday and yesterday and yesterday that it will arise again tomorrow. If you didn't remember it, you wouldn't know there was going to be any tomorrow. Because there isn't. Tomorrow is an illusion. so is yesterday. Simply isn't here. Where is it? Bring me tomorrow's newspaper.
Now this is perfectly marvelous arrangement, you see. So that you may feel, as you think these things over, that you are almost on the verge of going mad.
I sometimes feel that when I get involved in the sort of contemplative state. It is so weird and so far out that I think I'm going to lose my mind. But don't worry. You see, just like being dead. Just let go. And swing with it. Because it'll always bounce. And what makes you, gives you the sense of going mad is that you think you're not in control and that it's all lost and someone else is going to take over. Or something else is going to take over. Well, of course it has to. Because, like you say, when you've driven long enough in the car, and you say to your wife, will you drive for a while, please? You want relief. Or something else has to take over. But it's all you. So do you see that how the nature of being is constructed in this extraordinarily fascinating way? So that it constantly renews itself and therefore is worth going on by eternal forgetting and getting rid of itself. Now, you know, those people you've just been listening to chanting the sutras on Koyasan, which is the sort of ultimate center, retreat, inner sanctuary of Japanese practice of Vajrayana, Mahayana Buddhism, are a bunch of boys who are just like American college boys who play football, and they haven't the faintest idea what they're doing. Not today. They're doing this because their fathers have sent them there. Their fathers own temples, and they've got to carry on their father's tradition, because after all, the family business has to go on. And they have no more idea what this is all about than the man in the moon. And you and I can sit here and we could get swinging with this music, we could dance to it, and we could go very far out on it, which was what you were originally supposed to do. And for them it's a chore. It's a thing you have to get up for at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you have to memorize all this and you have to get it exactly right and do it. And they've completely forgotten what it was all about. But it was originally there. It's a funny thing how this happens, you see. But you see how I was explaining to you this morning how we have a rhythm between remembering and not remembering. You remember long enough to know that you're there. Because if you don't remember, nothing makes any impression upon you. Therefore, you are not there. But then when memory gets too much, and you're too much there, then you have to realize that all memory is an illusion, that there is nothing except the present moment. And that there is no future, as equally no past.
And then you're liberated. But when you get liberated, you have to come back in and play memory again. There's a cleaning process. In other words, you wipe off the blackboard, and then you start writing again. And then you wipe it off, and then you start writing again. And this is the process whereby life is kept going. So in the same way with these people, they have come to a point in the historical development of their way of life where they remember too much. It's not new to them. And all this therefore becomes what we call going through the motions. And so this is the same paradox that I was talking about this morning, that the echo, which is memory, is simultaneously what tells you you exist and what traps you. So in the sense that it tells you you exist, it's an advantage. To the extent that it traps you, it's a debt. You're in debt. You should be thankful. Somebody gave it to you. Ultimately, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Lord God did it all for you. And you should be thankful. And say, anything bad that I did was from me. Dear God, anything good that I did was from you. You see? What a marvelous mix-up that is. But all I'm saying is this. There is a point in all this development where you have to say to people, please come off it. In other words, these boys here in Koyasan, I was aching to know enough Japanese to say to them, do you realize what a great thing you have here? Couldn't you possibly enjoy it for a few minutes? And let's get together and all join hands around here and go through this again, these sutras, and really make it. So I'm talking, you see, about the same process of what has been called flip-floppability, whereby we switch from one attitude to another, one situation to another, and this pulse switch situation is the very nature of existence. That's why your heart does that. That's why all sounds, all light, everything is going blip, 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 blip. See? And so, because of that blip, you know you're here. Well, now, I've been trying to show how this game has its own inner meaning. So, finally, we've got to come round to one form of Mahayana that I haven't really discussed at all, to complete the whole scene, which is what is called the School of the Pure Land. And this is the most popular form of Mahayana Buddhism in the Far East. In China, in Japan, everywhere. The multitudes go for this kind. And it's all under the presiding image of the one of those Jnani Buddhas called Amitabha, whose name means boundless light, and who is a sort of a subdivision or aspect of Mahavairocana, who is the great Sun Buddha, and is therefore probably derived historically from Ahura Mazda, from Persia, the great sun god of the Mazdaeans and the Parsis. But although that may have been what set it all off, it has been greatly transformed by being canalized through Buddhism.
Now, you have all seen photographs of the Buddha at Kamakura, the Daibutsu, that enormous bronze figure that sits in a beautiful park with pine trees, the temple having long been demolished by a tidal wave, for which thanks be to God. Because if it hadn't been for the tidal wave, nobody would ever have really seen this figure. But there is at Kamakura this huge bronze figure. It's about 42 feet high. And here this creature sits, surrounded by a great busyness. Thousands of school children are all the time on tours, streaming by, photographers, people selling this, that, and the other, souvenirs, exhibitions of dwarf trees and everything, are all going on around. And here this thing sits and looks down forever. And nothing can hush it. I mean, let's put it this way. It hushes everything. That no matter how much turmoil of children, etc., is going on in this park, this huge face presides over everything. And you cannot ignore it. It subdues you into peace. Without doing it in an authoritative way. It doesn't say to you, shut up. It just is so peaceful that you cannot help catching the infection of peace that comes from this figure. And this is the figure of Amitabha. Not the historical Shakyamuni Gautama Buddha living in India, but one of the Jnani Buddhas, who is not manifested in the world. Now, the religion connected with this figure is called Pure Land Jodo, in Japanese, Shinshu, the true sect of the Pure Land. It comes again, the origins are always in India, but the Japanese, under the genius of Honen and Shinran, who were medieval Buddhist saints, developed their own special variety of it. And this is a very strange religion. Because it takes its basis as follows. We are living now in the most decadent period of history. That's what they say. And this comes back from the Hindu idea that this is the Kali Yuga. This is the end of time, where everything is completely fouled up. And this started in about 3000 BC. February the 23rd, 3023 BC, the Kali Yuga began. And it's got to last yet for 5000 years. And then everything will fall apart. The universe will disappear out of sheer failure. So that now, nobody can be virtuous. Because everybody who tries to be virtuous in this epoch of the world is merely showing off. It's not really pure. It's just pretending you're virtuous. It's a big act. In other words, so you give money to charity, not because you really love the people you're giving money to, but because you are under a sense of guilt and you feel you ought to. And therefore, because of that
inescapable bad motivation. Nobody can possibly liberate themselves from the chains of karma. The more you try to get out of your karma, that is to say your conditioning, your bondage to your past, the more you simply get yourself involved in it. And therefore, all human beings living in the end time of the Kali Yuga, or what the Japanese call Mappo, are just hopeless. Hopelessly selfish. So in this predicament, you cannot rely on jiriki, that means your own power, to get out, to get liberated from self. You have to rely on tariki, which is the power of something else altogether than you, something quite different. So in the Jodo Shinshu sect, the tariki, the other power, is represented in the form of Amitabha, or Japanese say Amida, this great beneficent Buddha figure who everybody loves. And he's so strangely different from any kind of authoritarian God figure that we have in the West. Amida doesn't bombinate. He sits there serenely, quiet. He doesn't preach. And all you have to do is to say his name in the formula Namu Amida Butsu, which means Namu, name, Amida Butsu, of Amida Buddha. Namu Amida Butsu. And all you have to do is to say that formula, and after death you will be reborn in a special paradise called Sukhavati, which is Jodo, the pure land, where becoming enlightened is a cinch. It has none of the difficulties surrounding it that we have in our ordinary life today. Everybody born in the pure land is born in the inside of a lotus. There's a huge lotus pond in front of where Amida sits with all his attendants. And the lotuses come up and they go pop, you know, as the bud breaks. And every time it goes pop like this, there's a new little being in there who is somebody who said the formula Namu Amida Butsu. And those are human beings who are now sitting on lotuses like Buddhas. And you should see, you go to Koyasan, and they have a great painting there in their museum of what it's like to arrive there. They have a huge panorama of Amitabha and all his attendants, and especially the apsaras. And she looks at you with lovely, longing eyes. And so, this is welcome to Amida's paradise, where you will all sit on lotuses and be Buddhas without any difficulty. But the point is, all you have to do to get there is to say Namo Amida Butsu. You don't even have to believe that it works. Now that is the religion of most Japanese Buddhists, believe it or not. In other words, if you really get this and feel that that's really going to happen to you, you'll be grateful, and you'll try to help other people and be a bodhisattva and so on, and you know, be generally helpful around the scene. But the whole idea is that you cannot do it by your own effort. And if the moment you think you can do it by your own effort, you're a phony. You have instead to
go completely with the other to disown your own power and capability of being virtuous, unselfish, etc. So then,
this kind of religion develops a peculiar kind of saint. And they call these people Myo Konin. Myo means wonderful. Ko means fine. Nin means man or person. There can be a woman, Myo Konin. It is not sexually restricted to men. So a Myo Konin is a very special kind of character. There are stories told about Myo Konin. There is one, for example, a traveling man who comes to a temple during the course of the night and walks in, and he takes the sacred cushions on which the priests sit and arranges them right in the front of the altar and goes to sleep. In the morning, the priest comes in and says, "What's going on here?" And the Myo Konin looks at him and says, "Oh, you must be a stranger. You don't belong to the family." Another time, he had great ability for calligraphy, doing beautiful writing. And people were always trying to get his calligraphy from him. And he was cagey about it. It wasn't so easy to get it. So one day, a very, very great man invited him for dinner and again left him alone in a reception room where there was stretched out on the floor some absolutely gorgeous paper with ink and brushes just waiting there. And he got so fascinated that he just couldn't resist. Well, like a child, he simply couldn't resist doing his calligraphy on that piece of paper. And suddenly, as he realized he had done it, that he had spoiled this gorgeous paper, you know, which was incredibly expensive, the host walked in and he apologized. He said, "Really, I don't know what to do. I'm so sorry. I couldn't resist the temptation to make some things on this beautiful paper." And the host said, "Oh, please don't worry about that." Because he had now possessed himself of a priceless object of art. This man's work today sells for thousands and thousands of dollars. So this is the spirit. I'm telling these anecdotes to try and illustrate the spirit of what's called a Myo Konin. Somebody in the swing of realizing that all the very great thing in life is not your own doing. That it comes from the side of things, the flip, in other words, of experience that you call other. There are some people, you see, who believe it comes from the split in experience you call yourself. That's the Jiriki people. The Tariki people believe it comes from the other. But now what happens is this. When you penetrate deeply into the doctrines of the Pure Land school, the simple people believe that there really is Amitabha Buddha sitting on his golden lotus surrounded by all those apsaras. Exactly from Japan, 108,000 miles to the west, there is a paradise where all those people sit, and where you will be reborn when you die. And the simple priests of the sect in the country villages today still insist that that's what you should believe. But the sophisticated priests don't believe that at all. They know that Amitabha is in you, only it is that side of you which you don't define as you. When you say,
I have a body, instead of saying, I am a body, that's because you feel that your body happens to you. That it's something you got mixed up with, that was given to you by your parents. You don't say, I beat my heart on purpose. You feel that your heart is something that happens to you. So all that side of things that you experience as a passive recipient of it is tariki.
But in all this, who are you? Who is the recipient of these gifts? Don't you see that self and other go together? That you don't need to cling to yourself because you have everything you called other, and that's you too.
That if you, but you only realize this if you explore it. If you go to an extreme. So you can go to the extreme by pursuing the idea of total courage, of letting go of everything, of being a true Zen monk and abandoning all your property and living in a barn and sitting in the middle of the night in the cold and eating rice and pickles and so on. And you can explore liberation that way. That's going to an extreme. But eventually you'll come round to the same point as the person who goes to the other extreme, which is no effort whatsoever. It comes of itself. Only he gets in a kind of bind too. Because when am I making no effort? Even if I say Namu Amida Butsu, I'm doing something about it. Now, I've got to stop saying this Namu Amida Butsu. You know, saying Namu Amida Butsu is so easy, but it's still a little bit work. And I mustn't do any work at all. How can you get to the point where you don't do any work at all? Well, you just mustn't do anything. And you find yourself that is as difficult as the other situation was. You see, to do nothing, really do nothing, with perfection, is as difficult as to do everything.